The president sent multiple tweets this morning about Omarosa Manigault Newman, his former staffer and TV protege, calling her wacky Omarosa. Trump said she was a loser and nothing but problems. Manigault Newman has released recordings of herself in conversation with President Trump and White House Chief of Staff John Kelly ahead of her upcoming book. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith is watching all of this and joins us now. Hi, Tam.
Hey.
So Omarosa has a long history with Trump. It was one of his most ardent defenders until this year. Now she says that John Kelly forced her out of the White House, and she today released a clip of a phone conversation with Trump, allegedly recorded after she stepped down. Here it is.
Omarosa, what's going on? I just saw on the news that you're thinking about leaving. What happened?
General Kelly came to me and said that you guys wanted me to leave.
No, nobody even told me about it. Nobody.
Wow.
You know, they run a big operation, but I didn't know it. I didn't know that.
So Manigault Newman also recorded John Kelly in the Situation Room, which is, by the way, a place where electronic devices aren't allowed. What have we learned so far from her tapes?
That's a good question. We have learned most notably that she was recording her conversations with people in the White House, that she recorded this call with the president, and that she was recording in the Situation Room, which, as you say, is a place where electronics need not arrive. There are cubbies outside of the Situation Room where people are supposed to put their personal electronics. Beyond that, the point that she is trying to make with these clips is that somehow President Trump is out of touch with his White House, that the White House is being run by Chief of Staff John Kelly, or at least was at the time. It's a little bit of a curious argument in that the job of a chief of staff traditionally in a White House is to sort of wall the president off from things like HR matters and to do things like hire and fire employees.
Well, and in one of the tapes that Omarosa released between her and General Kelly, when he's basically firing her in the Situation Room, he does say, like, the people in the White House report to me, not President Trump. So she made an issue of that on Meet the Press yesterday. Here she is talking to Chuck Todd on Meet the Press. She says that she had to record these conversations in order to protect her reputation.
This is a White House where everybody lies. The president lies to the American people. Sarah Huckabee stands in front of the country and lies every single day. You have to have your own back, because otherwise you'll look back and you'll see 17 knives in your back.
What about that part of her argument? And this is something that we have heard from others who've worked in the White House, that people are always trying to protect themselves, even if it means taking somebody else down.
There are warring factions in this White House. This is something that has been basically the story of the Trump White House, is, you know, it much like reality television, in fact, where there are feuding factions. That's sort of the way that this White House has been arranged. It's the leakiest White House that anybody can remember, with people leaking things that benefit themselves and hurt others. And in Omarosa's book, which I have read, she talks about at one point compiling a list of people who she thought should be fired.
Now, she says she has more tapes. How has the White House responded to all this? Or are they worried?
She has tapes. They don't know what the tapes are, what's on those tapes. President Trump has been tweeting up a storm about her this morning, which in some ways gives her the gift of another news cycle where when there is a feud, that helps ratings. President Trump calls her wacky. The White House has said that that her book is full of lies. There hasn't been sort of a point-by-point rebuttal, however, of the claims that she makes in her book. And many of those claims, I should say, are very hard to verify, if not impossible to verify.
Tamara, just in the minute we have left, we've also got news today that Peter Strzok was fired from the FBI last Friday. The president and his allies have criticized Strzok for anti-Trump text messages he sent while investigating the Trump campaign. What does this mean for the White House, that he's out?
Well, what it means is, I don't think that we will expect to see President Trump stop tweeting about this. He has been a regular punching bag for the president on social media. And the president again today tweeted about him, saying that, hey, maybe this means that the, quote, witch hunt should be dropped. Strzok's lawyer says that the decision to terminate him was out of political pressure and outside of the normal course of things, and basically punishes him for his protected First Amendment right to send text messages privately about whatever he wants.
It's NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the story now about working for the federal government and trying to make a difference. It's what motivates many people to become civil servants, since most of the jobs aren't glamorous. But when President Trump took office pledging to drain the swamp, the lives of some federal workers changed radically, as we hear from Patrick Madden of member station WAMU, who spoke with some of them and has this report.
Sanute Chandy has spent her legal career fighting discrimination. She's worked at public interest firms, at D.C.'s Office of Human Rights. But when the opportunity to lead the Civil Rights Division of the Health and Human Services Agency came along, that was too good to pass up.
Whether it be about language access or about health care for transgender individuals, reproductive rights, you have so much opportunity to do good within the federal government.
Scientist Joel Clement is a trained forest biologist, more at home sampling soil in the woods of Maine than huddled behind a cramped desk in D.C. But like Chandy, Clement realized the power of the federal government and joined the Department of the Interior in 2010.
The thing that seemed the most important to me was working with the Alaska Natives in the Arctic who are facing the impacts of climate change to the point where their villages are some of them, on the verge of being wiped right off the map.
Clement and Chandy became members of the Senior Executive Service, or SES, the top-ranking civil servants in the federal government. Congress created the SES after the Watergate scandal to attract the best and brightest into government. SES members could easily transfer between departments and put their sense of mission to use. Then Donald Trump was elected. Trump's mission has seemed to be focused on undoing many of Obama's civil rights initiatives. Here he is at the Values Voter Summit in October 2017.
But I pledge that in a Trump administration, our nation's religious heritage would be cherished, protected, and defended like you have never seen before. That's what's happening.
Chandy knew with Trump in office there'd be changes, especially when it came to her agency's role in making sure companies didn't discriminate against LGBTQ patients on the basis of religious freedom.
We now had leaders who had been activists against the very mission that we stood for.
Civil servants know their job is to carry out the political objectives of the administration, Democratic or Republican. And that can be tough, especially for people who came to work under a previous White House with different priorities and policies. If they don't like the new policies, they can leave. Vanderbilt professor David Lewis studies the federal civil service. He says what's different about Trump is that he's downright suspicious of the federal workforce.
I think just questioning the professionalism of civil servants and assuming that somehow partisan political views, or if you voted a particular way or contributed to a particular candidate, that somehow that determines the kind of behavior you'll engage in as a federal worker. Those things are unusual, I think, for presidents and pretty noteworthy.
And that attitude was certainly felt inside the agencies. One night in July of last year, Clement, along with dozens of other senior-level staffers at Interior, learned he'd been transferred. Instead of working with Alaskan tribes, he'd be collecting royalty checks from gas companies.
They were clearly doing a form of a purge, and I didn't know what to do.
The Interior Department wasn't alone. At the State Department, hundreds of career staffers, including former ambassadors, were reassigned to clerical work. Over at EPA, four high-level employees were sidelined after raising questions about former Director Scott Pruitt's spending and management. Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute says tension between career civil servants and political appointees is normal and built into the system.
But we almost never see it used in a fashion designed to demand personal loyalty, to ignore malfeasance.
Ornstein says nowhere has that been more evident than at the senior executive service level, where federal rules make it easier to be transferred or reassigned.
And for the first time that I've seen in that 40-year history, we're seeing it used in a punitive way to intimidate or punish people who aren't viewed as loyal or going along with the program.
The White House didn't respond to a request for comment. Eventually, both Chandy and Clement decided to leave the federal government. Both found work at nonprofits. While it's unknown how many senior-level employees have resigned since Trump was elected or how many face transfers or reassignment, it is known that this administration is full of vacancies. And at the same time, the administration has taken tangible steps, like making it easier to fire federal employees, weakening their unions, and trying to cut their pensions. David Lewis of Vanderbilt says if enough federal workers leave, sooner or later, we'll all feel the impact.
And if people with that kind of expertise are no longer there, then it becomes very difficult to do things like, you know, ensure fair housing or write good rules or land planes.
Lewis says we're likely to have to live with these consequences for a long time. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Madden.
We're going to spend a few minutes now on a disagreement over a point of view. What's not debatable is a statistic at the heart of the flare-up. According to this year's census data, white Americans are projected to lose majority status for the first time by 2045. Washington Post reporter Terrence McCoy wrote an article in July showing how that had already happened in a Bell & Evans chicken processing facility in Fredericksburg, Pennsylvania. The article was titled "White and in the Minority, She Speaks English, Her Co-workers Don't. Inside a Rural Chicken Plant, Whites Struggle to Fit In." It profiled 20-year-old Heaven Engel and her boyfriend, increasingly isolated, lonely, and angry at work because they don't speak Spanish. Well, Terrence's inbox exploded. A group of Hispanic journalists from Latino Rebels, a Latino media outlet, wrote an editorial in which they called the article a John Hughes teen angst film gone haywire. McCoy makes us all want to take out the tissues and cry for the two white tragic heroes they wrote about while depicting the Latino workers as lacking humanity. We're going to hear from Julio Ricardo Varela, one of the authors of that editorial. But first, Terrence McCoy. Terrence, what was the goal of your piece?
I was trying to say exactly what we said. We live in a time right now of very controversial policies. And what researchers are increasingly finding is that the support for a lot of these policies are rooted in white racial anxiety that a lot of whites are feeling with this changing country demographically. And this story set out to explore and illuminate the anxieties that are at the root of a lot of the policies that we're seeing roiling the country today.
Well, and so you profile this young woman at this facility, the Bell & Evans chicken processing plant. She is one of the few, maybe a handful, of white English-speaking workers, and we start to see how alone she feels. Can you see, though, how someone might read that as why should we feel sorry for her and her boyfriend who also works there when all these coworkers have gone through that themselves before as Spanish-speaking people in this country?
This is a story that's taking a new look at a very old issue. In the United States, obviously, millions and millions and millions of Latinos and Black Americans and immigrant families have been facing these same sort of struggles their entire lives. This is a story about white Americans who are learning about a changing role of their own race in demography. So what we set out to do was to take a look at how whites are interacting now in America. And what researchers are increasingly finding is the fact that a lot of these anxieties that they're feeling is at the root of a lot of policies that we're seeing in America today.
You speak to those who've studied this. Rachel Wetz, for instance, of the University of California at Berkeley, describes many whites as feeling threatened, even if not directly affected by the change. There's a sense of we have to band together because we are a threatened group. And the way you describe this young woman and her boyfriend, she increasingly feels that way. In the beginning, she says things like, maybe I should have stuck with Spanish. I should have studied more Spanish. Then over time, she starts to think, well, maybe those workers should learn English. You were trying to take us inside the mind of this young woman who felt threatened and alone as opposed to supporting her feelings.
I never write a story with any intention of trying to either sympathize with someone or make them look unsympathetic. I'm looking to portray them as they are. You know, at the end of the day, I don't want to write for, you know, the Twitterati. Mm. So, I mean, this is a story that was controversial. And, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us as journalists and reporters to tell the story of what's happening in America. And this is a story that was presenting Heaven Engel and her boyfriend Vincent Heim as they were.
And we also meet some of the people they interact with. Denise Salvador, for instance, is a 25-year-old from the Dominican Republic. She picks up some of the chicken parts that Heaven, your young white worker, has processed. And they can't speak to each other because they don't speak the language. And you talk about how Heaven had hoped, because they interact every day, there might be a friendship there. But she understands that they can't be because they don't speak the same language. You also let us know that Denise had some of those same feelings of being isolated, but neither woman had the time to learn another language. Some suggested, why didn't you give us a profile of Denise Salvador?
Well, at the Washington Post, we have a long history of profiling immigrants and as they come to this country, and also of the immigrant struggle, the hardships that they face. This story was about the anxieties that some whites are feeling as the country catapults towards majority-minority America. And what that means, this story was about white people and how they're dealing with those anxieties. And that's why we chose to focus on them.
See the world as they see it. Are you surprised by the response?
I was surprised to a certain extent that it was read as widely as it was. But, you know, I'm really hopeful about that because obviously it resonated with people. You know, I think it's something that we can all be optimistic about.
And to what end?
When you're talking about hardline immigration policies or policies that appear to specifically target minority groups, we need to understand where the support is coming from. You can make the argument that the most resonant policy that Donald Trump has been about immigration. This is something that he's come back to time and again in rally after rally, and people cheer about it. We need to understand what is at the root of those cheers, why people feel the way they do. And this is a story that set out to illuminate and take a look at those fears.
Terrence McCoy, Washington Post reporter, will post again his piece on the sense of isolation felt by some young white workers at a processing plant with mostly Latino, Spanish-speaking workers. Terrence, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
All right, let's bring in Julio Ricardo Varela, digital media director for Futuro Media. He also co-hosts In the Thick, a political podcast from journalists of color. Julio, you were one of those saying, we only saw the Latino workers like the Dominican Denise through the lens of Heaven's white fear. You've heard Terrence's reasoning. You say what?
There's so much to unpack there. Because I think you could speak to anxiety and still tell a full story. Because the biggest problem I have with this piece, it really never humanized the Latino workers. So my thing is, the anxiety is there, and the Latino workers, mostly Dominican and Puerto Ricans, are seen as sort of these zombies.
But again, this is Terrence's point. He wanted us to feel the isolation that the white workers feel, which he pointed out is the same isolation that people who don't speak English feel when they're in an English-speaking environment, that this is how other workers have felt.
But he doesn't talk to anyone about it. I mean, if that was the point of his piece, then why don't you dedicate as much copy to the Dominican worker? I'm not buying it. There's no humanity in these descriptions.
This young woman, Heaven, thought she was going to have a friendship with one of the workers. They thought they were going to humanize them, but they couldn't. They couldn't speak the language.
So basically, the argument is saying that the vast majority of Latinos that work in the rural, like, Pennsylvania area only speak Spanish? I mean, Puerto Rican workers didn't just magically appear in 2017 in chicken plants. There's a history of them coming in the 30s and the 40s. And why frame it here through this type of isolation? And to actually equate this to anti-immigrant feelings? We wrote this piece in Latino Rebels that it was like a bad John Hughes movie with zombies. And the zombies were the Latino workers. I'm not the only person who's saying this. Every Latino, Latina journalist that I spoke to about this piece had deep problems with how this story was framed.
He does paint scenes, though, of this woman, Denise, the co-worker that interacts mm-hmm. with Heaven, but they can't speak to each other. She cannot speak English. If it was a profile of a recently arrived immigrant who was working in an English-speaking environment in a factory and he could not communicate with his co-workers and was feeling increasingly isolated, would you feel the same way?
I'd love to see that much copy in the Washington Post with that much prominence about those stories. Those stories don't exist in the Washington Post or in the New York Times as much as you think. Those stories actually exist by people like me that have created our own independent media because we were asking that very same question, Robin. It's like, where are those stories?
And how about getting some insight into the anger over immigration policy? It shows Heaven, the young white worker, going to a big training session, and it is entirely in Spanish. Spanish with interpretation just for her and one other worker, but the interpreter falls behind. We see her start off thinking, maybe I'm going to learn Spanish, and this is a young girl who wasn't very good in school, doesn't have the time or the skills, perhaps, to learn another language, and we see her change over the course of the article to someone with her arms across her chest.
What it didn't look into was that history of rural Pennsylvania. I don't think the issue of why is Pennsylvania sort of this underbelly of white supremacist groups and hate groups, and come down to rural Pennsylvania, I've covered it, where the demographic is shifting and the people that are getting the voices are the ones who are like, I'm afraid of the immigrants. Oh, my life. And I think that's a big problem with how journalism, and mostly, I hate to say it, white male journalists and editors in positions of power who are looking through the wrong lens and are saying, you know, we're going to justify fear and anxiety and xenophobia and don't really get into the foundations of it or where it all began and the history of black and brown and white relations in Pennsylvania. We talk about that area in Pennsylvania, and it's changed. It's mostly Puerto Rican. It's mostly Dominican. And I have to remind people, Puerto Ricans are not immigrants. Terrence, whether consciously or subconsciously, is trying to portray this anti-immigrant fear when, in fact, you're probably dealing with generations of people who have lived in Pennsylvania, who have set roots in Pennsylvania, and then all of a sudden, that's who you're afraid of? Come down to rural Pennsylvania and see how Puerto Ricans get treated. And it's incredibly dangerous. That's the biggest problem that I have with the piece. It's definitely the framing.
That's Julio Ricardo Varela, digital media director for Futura Media, also co-host of In the Thick, the political podcast by journalists of color. We'll put your group editorial from Latino Rebels and Terrence's article at herenow.org. We urge people to read them both. Julio, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin. I appreciate it.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We got more information today on how Saudi Arabia may fit into Elon Musk's plans to take Tesla private. In a blog post today, he said he has been approached multiple times by Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund about taking Tesla private. Saudi Arabia's investment fund has already taken a nearly 5% stake in Tesla. Sharice Jones of USA Today joins us now. Hi, Sharice.
Hello.
So Musk had that surprise tweet last week. We talked a lot about it, that he wants to take the company private. The stock jumped on that news. He would have to buy out other shareholders in order to take Tesla private. And many were skeptical about whether he had the money to do that, especially at the price he mentioned, which was $420 a share. What do we know now about this potential funding from Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, so Elon Musk put a blog post on the Tesla website this morning basically saying that he had the support of the managing director of the Saudi Wealth Fund to potentially back a bid to go private if all the approvals are in place. So it wasn't quite as committal as the tweets made it sound last week, but he is saying that they're on board if this is something that comes to pass.
Kind of interesting that Saudi Arabia, which is a country whose economy is dependent completely on oil, would want to take such a stake in an electric car company.
Well, that's part of the problem. They are so dependent on oil that they realize that they've got to diversify or they're going to be very vulnerable financially and politically, given the fluctuations in that market. So they're trying to invest in other areas. And as you said, they already own 5% of the shares in Tesla, which amounts to about $3 billion worth.
Meanwhile, many people, investors included, were very upset with Elon Musk for how he rolled all this news out and that he had such an effect on the stock price. They had to halt trading for a while. There have been two federal lawsuits now against Musk, accusing him of making false statements when he proposed paying $420 a share to buy each Tesla share back. Tell us more about those lawsuits.
Yeah, they're basically saying that he was trying to manipulate the stock price, and it did shoot up about $45 that day versus where it had been the day before. They're also saying that he was basically lying, saying that he had this financial commitment and that he had investor support. So they have gone to court to make it known that they were displeased with this, and even the SEC is looking into those tweets.
Okay, well, we'll continue to follow that story. And meanwhile, while we have you, there is the big economic news going on with regards to Turkey. The lira there dropped to another record low today. It fell nearly 10%. It is down more than 40% against the dollar so far this year. Markets across Asia also dropped today as they watch what's going on in Turkey, which involves this U.S. pastor that's been detained, and President Trump is trying to put pressure on Turkey economically in order to get that pastor released. But as somebody, you know, right there in New York, how are you watching this in terms of its impact on the markets?
I mean, it's having a lot of impact at this point. I mean, Turkey is going through so much, right, with the high inflation and the plummeting currency and the authoritarian impulses in the government. And this is having ripple effects in emerging markets around the world. But they have such a unique set of problems that it's probably going to be an isolated case. But it is making markets pretty jittery and everybody's keeping their eye out.
That's Charisse Jones of USA Today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Each week until the election, we're taking a look at a different Senate race as part of our Senate Tracker series. Today, Ohio, where Democratic incumbent Sherrod Brown hopes to secure a third term against Republican U.S. Congressman Jim Renacci. Ohio is a state President Trump carried by 8 points in 2016, but it is always a toss-up. Joining us now from Cleveland is politics reporter Andrew Tobias at Cleveland.com. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.
And Senator Brown has been in Ohio politics since 1975 when he was elected to the State House, fresh out of his undergrad education at Yale. He is a progressive who wears a gold pin of a canary in a cage on his lapel to signify the plight of the American worker. Tell us more about Sherrod Brown.
Well, so despite kind of being graduating from Yale and being the son of a doctor, he's spent decades kind of building up this kind of normal everyman kind of image. He kind of has rumpled hair. His suits don't fit exactly right. I think he might even wear Velcro shoes. And he's got this kind of like gravelly voice that I'm told myself I would not try to do an impression of him when I came on this show. So, but he's really good at talking about the Indians. Like he's just, like I said, it's this whole vibe and he comes off as very genuine, authentic. But I guess the interesting thing about him is that he is very liberal. He is populist, so it kind of gives him actually more sort of political cover than you'd think in this kind of era where Donald Trump won in Ohio so decisively. And so he is running for re-election in a political climate that hypothetically should be a little rough for him given the long-term kind of trends playing out in Ohio. Obviously, he has the wind at his back with the Democratic energy and stuff like that out there. But it's a really interesting test of sort of just these years that he's spent building up who he is.
Well, let's listen to an ad from his campaign, because the point you're making here, it's actually an interesting balancing act that he's got going on here. He is actually in favor of some of President Trump's tariffs. Here he is.
Night and day, they work making the best steel in the world. And Ohio workers should have a senator who works hard for them. I'm Sherrod Brown. I've made protecting Ohio jobs my top priority. I'm proud I voted against NAFTA and against trade deals with Colombia and South Korea and opposed the Trans-Pacific Partnership that put our jobs at risk. Plenty of senators stand up for Wall Street, but I work for Ohio. That's why.
It's an interesting calculation there for a Democrat to make.
Yeah, actually, you know, sort of when we were looking at 2016, one of the things that struck me at the time was that Donald Trump's message on trade was actually pretty similar to Sherrod Brown's. And so trade isn't the defining issue in any election necessarily, but it's something that is really important to areas that traditionally were manufacturing centers and, as you know, have fallen off in recent years and led to a lot of economic hardship. And so Sherrod Brown actually has, while it is a tricky political situation, it also kind of almost contradictorily is sort of like a good ground for him.
His opponent, Jim Renacci, has aligned himself closely with President Trump. Here's his first TV ad.
Jim Renacci, conservative for Senate.
He's been behind me from day one, Jim Renacci.
Jim knows the Trump agenda works for Ohio. As a businessman, Renacci created 1,500 jobs, and he knows the president's tax cuts are creating more. Jim knows we need to secure our borders now, and Jim knows we need a Senate that works for us.
Jim, get in there and fight. Get in there and fight. We need you.
I'm Jim Renacci.
So he's tying himself very closely to President Trump there. Tell us more about Renacci.
So Jim Renacci is a self-made millionaire. He's one of the richest members of Congress. Before his career in politics, he dabbled in different businesses, including nursing homes. He actually owned an Arena League football team for a while. And he went from small town mayor to, in 2010, he was elected to Congress. And leading up to last year, he actually was running for governor. And when the Republican candidate dropped out in January, he sort of was the guy who stepped up and was recruited basically by President Trump's political team to get in the race. He stepped into kind of like a weird situation where obviously the other guy had been running for quite a while. And so he kind of was the late minute substitute, I guess. And so ever since then, he's really cloaked himself in President Trump. Renacci actually was interesting politically in that leading up to the 2016 Republican National Convention here in Cleveland, he was willing to really be a messenger out in front, speaking on behalf of the convention, saying things are going to go well. He was a supporter of the president's at a time where a lot of Ohio Republican apparatus was still with Ohio Governor John Kasich. And so I guess now he's looking to kind of cash in some of the IOUs that he got then.
We're hearing a lot about tax cuts, about tariffs. Is the economy the big issue in this race?
Yeah, it's Ohio's economy. The economic growth here has been lagging behind the rest of the country for a long time. It's been a long-term political trend. And so Renacci is hoping that by supporting the president's agenda, the president is still relatively popular here, although he won here by 8 points. And so Renacci has been basically everything the president's for, he's for it too.
Do social issues or foreign policy issues come up much?
I would say no. It might be a wedge issue, where one of the things that Renacci's people might want to use against Brown is say he might say that he's for the average person, the Ohio worker, but really his extremist left-wing liberal friends are for so-and-so. It's more of a, as opposed to directly talking about those issues, I think it's kind of indirectly addressing them by trying to characterize Brown's stance as being out of touch with sort of average Ohioans. But no, international issues, as you brought that up, you don't hear about that.
So just last week, everybody was watching Ohio because of this congressional race, a special election between Democrat Danny O'Connor and Republican Troy Balderson. It's kind of still a dead heat. Balderson is slightly ahead. The race has not been called yet. This is a district that President Trump carried by double digits in 2016. So as you look at that and look at the Senate race right now, what are voters telling you about, you know, what they think of these candidates?
I think that that election result, you know, you see after that Republicans kind of spiking the football a little bit, saying that Democrats made all this noise and they ultimately lost. Look at the scoreboard. They lost. We win. That kind of stuff. But privately, I mean, I think Republicans will acknowledge that it looks like Balderson, the Republican in that race, is going to win, but it's going to be less than one percentage point. Given the kind of geography of that district, it's pretty troubling for Republicans that a Democrat would be able to compete so well. So I guess all of the evidence that we see points to some wind at the Democrats' back, just kind of relative to what sort of the average political environment would be in Ohio. So yeah, it's a positive sign for Democrats for sure.
Where is the money coming from for the candidates in the Senate race? And you mentioned that Renacci is wealthy. There are questions about how much of his own fortune he's going to pour into his campaign.
So Brown has tapped into a lot of just the national Democratic fundraising apparatus. There's an organization called Act Blue that helps kind of corral small donations and send them across the country. And then otherwise, he has some senior positions on committee assignments and things like that. So it's just kind of a mix of traditional political donors that might contribute to campaigns and, like I said, sort of the small donor apparatus from across the country. And for Renacci, he has actually struggled to raise money relative to sort of what you might expect for a big-time Senate race like this. He has put a few million dollars of his own money into his campaign, which is a pretty substantial portion of what he's raised, and otherwise tapping into traditional Ohio Republican donors as well. And so there is kind of a pretty big fundraising disparity between what Brown and Renacci have raised so far, and that probably, again, pointing back to sort of some of the advantages that seem to be pointing in Brown's direction, that's another one.
What polls are you watching and what are they saying so far?
So the polling that has come out, Quinnipiac University, which is kind of one of the gold standards when it comes to state-level polling, and I think it was Monmouth University. And in June, they put out a couple of polls that complemented each other and basically showed the race being around a 10-point lead for Brown. There hasn't been anything that's come out more recently than that. But one of the things that we do look for is that there is a national Republican fundraising apparatus that is spending millions of dollars in some of these hotly contested Senate races across the country. There's obviously the equivalent of that on Democratic side. And we've seen just a total lack of outside spending in this race. I mean, in 2012, Brown's last time he ran for re-election, there's something like $40 million in outside money that was spent. The last I checked, it was somewhere around $500,000 and hasn't shown any signs of picking up. So you just kind of look at that between the polling and the lack of outside spending. You can read the tea leaves and say that sort of the smart political money doesn't see this one as being particularly close right now.
Do you expect President Trump to come back and campaign again for Renacci?
I do. It's arguably, there are better targets for him to sort of spend his time in when it comes to some of these other Senate races that are up for grabs. But Ohio is very important to him. The president actually had one of his first real estate projects of his career in Cincinnati. Obviously, in 2016, he had a big win here. He spent a lot of time then. And I think that they do see sort of the political value in a state like Ohio being in their control and having a guy like Renacci in office. So, yeah, I mean, no matter what the situation looks like, I would expect the president to spend some time here between now and November.
That's Andrew Tobias, political reporter at Cleveland.com, talking with us about the Senate race in Ohio as part of our Senate Tracker series. Andrew, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thousands of people came together today in the Yemeni city of Sada for funerals for the dozens of people, mostly children, killed in that airstrike last week on a school bus taking kids on a summer field trip. The strike was carried out by the Sunni Muslim Saudi monarchy, which has been leading a coalition in Yemen, supported by the U.S., against the Iran-backed Shia Houthis. The Saudis said it was a legitimate military operation in retaliation for an earlier missile from the Houthis, who have launched missiles into Saudi Arabia. This is all part of an ongoing civil war that the UN says is the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abby Maximum is president of Oxfam America. She's just back from a recent trip to Yemen. Abby, how would you describe what's going on there?
Well, Robin, what I saw, I was in Sana'a and north of Sana'a in Amran and Hamar. I was in an internally displaced persons camp in Hamar and met with families who had been displaced for more than 3 years, as well as some who had arrived as recently as 2 weeks prior because of risk of and fear of airstrikes and attacks in the southern port of Hodeidah. And I met with a woman named Fadila, who fled 2 weeks earlier, had spent the last of her life savings to bring her and her three kids and husband to this camp. And these are families who now have the hope of living on one meal a day, but without the fear of active airstrikes.
Well, what happens if the port of Al-Hodeidah, which is controlled by the Houthis, is attacked? Earlier this summer, the Saudi coalition did try to retake it. But how much aid, how dependent are people on that port?
Well, it is a port that is dependent on about 70% of the imports in the country. And so already, because of the ongoing war, it and some of the other ports have trickled to a standstill. And what I saw, the implications of that is incredible inflation, exorbitant prices that put basic food out of reach for most Yemenis, prices of commodities, and they do reach markets. I was able to see supermarkets that are full of a diversity of goods that only a very limited number of people who have resources can purchase. But we know there's 8.4 million people on the brink of starvation already. That's the entire population of the state of Virginia. Certainly in the displaced persons camp, there were many cases. There were 30 cases of children and pregnant and lactating women who were suffering from acute malnutrition and on the verge of starvation. And it was very easy to see that this is a population countrywide that is really affected by potential famine conditions.
Well, in a 2017 cholera epidemic, which we remember the outbreak then, the largest and fastest outbreak of the disease ever on record. But, you know, the UN says that both sides, the Saudi-led coalition and the Houthis, have carried out actions that could be called war crimes, targeting hospitals, healthcare facilities. So how do you see this ever being resolved?
Well, when I was there, Robin, there was more hope and more activity and action. This was 2 weeks ago, around the UN Special Envoy's efforts to bring the parties to the negotiating and peace table. And in our view, in our experience, the military solution is doing protracted harm. There are losers and losers and losers, and civilians at scale are the ones that are trapped in the crosshairs. And this is something I saw and witnessed during my trip. I spoke with survivors of airstrikes, which are backed by the United States government.
Was this at a cement factory you visited?
The cement factory I visited was attacked by airstrikes and cluster bombs 2 years ago, and in a Houthi-controlled area. And for those who did not take a side, it really showed, and people spoke of this, we'll never forgive. Before, I wasn't on a side, and now I am.
People were radicalized by it.
The stories I heard and the efforts to show me what had happened really showed how divisive and toxic the continued violence is. And in the case of the U.S. is in a position where it has huge influence to bring the parties to the table. Right now, though, the U.S. is being both an arms broker and, at times, a peace broker. And those two are in contradiction with each other.
Selling arms to Saudi Arabia? And
yes.
Then, yeah, backing up that coalition. But how are kids going on a summer field trip in all of this? I mean, terrible that this bus was attacked, but it reminds us, are there attempts at normalcy?
Certainly there are attempts at normalcy, both in displaced communities and host communities who are hosting displaced populations. I met with women involved in a livelihoods and income-generating project who want to resume normal practices. They want a better life for their children.
Abby Maxman, president of Oxfam America, just back from a trip to Yemen. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Robin.
A terrible time there. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.